Hello, horror fans. Welcome to Selling the Scream, a show about horror movies brought to you by one horror noob and one horror nerd. Horror is a really hard word to say, apparently. I am Jed Donaldson, the aforementioned noob. With me today, as usual, my friend and co-conspirator, Josh, Mr. Furious Yoakum. How's it going, Josh?
I hate you! It's going pretty well.
Nice.
How are you doing?
You know, I'm here as my youngest birthday today, so we did some birthday stuff. We'll talk about that in a second. We are not just joined by Josh today. We have a returning champion. Mr. Jason Duff is also with us. How's it going, Jason?
Yeah, let's hear it for Jason.
All right. Can't clap too close to the mic because that'll fuck up the levels.
Now, I can only assume that Jennifer is sick, which is why I got this call. So I do want to send my best wishes to Jennifer on a speedy recovery.
Right, she would be here, but she's deathly ill. The only reason she would miss an episode.
She's getting make a wish requests right now, and so just a prayer. We reached out. There was a tie between y'all. This is the tiebreaker. It is now back in your favor for most
the
appearances on the show.
Implies that there's not going to be any more episodes. We have to go back, or we're just done with one of them.
you're our first six timer.
I just wish I didn't get this honor with her being what I assume is sick from not washing her hands nearly enough.
Yeah, that's we'll maybe get into some pandemic feelings in this episode for sure.
I don't know why,
but we'll get there. Jen, you want to talk about you said you got some birthday shenanigans going on.
It's my youngest boy's ninth birthday today, which is insane to me. Not just because he's really tiny and still looks like he's three, but how has it been 9 years already? I don't know, but it has.
Now, Josh, Jed, how old were you when you first saw your first like really gruesome horror movie, and was it older or younger than nine?
Oh, way younger.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I snuck peeks at like stuff like five or six that would ruin my kid for life.
I have to say that I don't think I intentionally watched anything terrible prior to that age. But I guarantee I saw horrible stuff on a TV screen at some point in time before that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine because I'm in the same place where, yeah, I know I dressed up as Freddy Krueger and sometime in elementary school, and I had like those little knife hands, and yeah, I watched several of the movies in elementary school, and I have an 11-year-old now, and just the thought of her watching one of those movies, like, yeah, she would have to move her bed into our bedroom for
a bunch of soft snowflakes that we're raising.
Yes, well, hopefully we get a chance to talk about that later in the show.
What's crazy to me is, like, you said you had a Freddy Krueger costume as a child. That sort of stuff was just okay back then. Like, you have, like, cartoons and toys made of Rambo and RoboCop, which are decidedly not children's films.
Yeah. Well, the year before or the year after I dressed as Freddy Krueger, I was very into the military. And so I was maybe, let's just call it the fourth grade at this point. And I asked my mom to take me to the Army surplus store because I wanted to buy kind of a realistic Halloween outfit. And so walked into the store. The owner showed us a few different, costumes and helmets. And I found something I really
uniforms,
liked.
Jason.
Yeah. Well, actually, they were uniformed. Yes, absolutely. These were uniforms. And we wore them to school and we did like a little parade around one of the neighborhoods and they captured pictures of it. And, my dad, a few days later, like saw the picture and said, hey, is there any reason our son is dressed as a World War II German soldier? And so I was wearing a German army uniform in the fourth or fifth grade. Now, it had no Nazi insignia, but like anyone who's seen the History Channel, like it's a very distinct uniform designed by Hugo Boss, actually. And so, I don't know which one is more disturbing.
I mean, Coco Chanel could have designed those too. They're both real fun Nazis.
Isn't that funny? And they both have staying power.
Hell yeah! Hell yeah! You gotta applaud them for that.
Was this when y'all were in Florida, or is this Ohio?
This is Ohio.
Okay. But I'm maybe more confused. I think that makes more sense in Florida.
Especially yeah. I would have been welcomed in Florida for sure.
I was going to say, I'm surprised that the man at the surplus store didn't steer you away from that. Like,
oh, to be clear, I'm pretty sure the man at the surplus store was probably a neo-Nazi, which is why he had these costumes and these uniforms in stock. And so
I thought you were going to say, I saw what I liked and I had my heart set, couldn't be dissuaded.
Yeah. Well, kind of a corollary story was, I also belonged to a military history book club, and that also got me on the mailing list of pretty much every militia and racist organization in the country. So I was in the sixth grade receiving all these mailers from like the Michigan militia. My parents were trying to figure out, how is our 11-year-old on these mailing lists? And we figured out it was the military history book club.
It usually is.
Yeah.
You got radicalized like pre-social media. You got like, you had to like send out like a self-addressed stamped envelope to get
it. Back when they had to work for it.
Yeah.
I'm enrolling my boy, speaking of my kiddo, got him signed up for a like introduction to theater class. I know you've talked about your daughter doing plays before. We are thinking about trying to do something creative with him, because he's basically just kind of in athletic stuff now. Let him know about it. And then he got this like strange look on his face and just looked at me and said, "Dad, I don't want to be an extra." So I don't know where he got this fear of being a background performer from.
Is it fear, or is it just confidence? Just
yeah, he knows his worth.
Yeah,
slay queen.
Well, I mean, like you do need people in movies who are like doctors standing in the background holding clipboards and nodding, right? Like that's
honest
work.
I will not disagree with you, but some people shine too bright.
I mean, and this movie that we're about to talk about too also has some amazing extras.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. I was about to say, you stole my lead in there. Do we talk about interrupting the host here on the podcast, Jason?
Yeah, go ahead, Jason. Since listen, you have all the words, listen,
Josh, I've come a long way since I was young, dressing as a German World War II soldier. So you have to at least be happy about my progress.
It's touch and go for a minute in middle school, but we came through it all right.
Yep.
We do not talk about interrupting hosts, because that's bullshit.
Hey, Jed, that reminds me, actually.
I was finished.
Oh.
Jokes on you.
Good try.
Ooh.
We in fact, talk about horror movies, specifically ones that Josh has put together in a list to attempt to turn me into a fan of the genre, yada, 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 yada. Some are good.
It's not a yada, yada, or the premise of our show.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at now.
You're trying to get you to like horror movies. My track record is pretty good, right? That's the yadas.
Yeah, like generally speaking, yeah, some of them are good. I guess technically most of them are good.
But yeah, this time we got a doozy. We got 28 Days Later, the movie that I think I said last time, kind of like single-handedly restarted the zombie craze. I think there's an asterisk next to that, because there was one other thing that came out, but this is definitely, I think, led to Walking Dead and the Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead remake and World War Z, and kind of all that is kind of the fallout of this movie doing so well and salvaging.
I think it's kind of weird to, I mean, I understand why you would say it kickstarted the zombie thing, because lots of zombie movies that followed this kind of cribbed from it a little bit, but I mean, they're not technically zombies in this movie. They're just sick people. And the way they win is by letting them starve to death.
Hey, jeez, guys, I know we're a spoiler show.
I was just going to say, this podcast is a lot better when you two just agree on everything. So let's just find the common ground.
We can agree they're not zombies.
Yeah, the Danny Boyle, as when they were doing press for this movie, would frequently correct people. They were infected. He would avoid using the Z word, as another British zombie movie would say a couple years later. But he's working off this Alex Garland script that's definitely in conversation, at least with like their Romero movies, for sure.
I'm not saying it doesn't share a lot of common ground with zombie films. It certainly does.
Yeah, but you are correct in that, like, these are sick people. They're not dead. They did not die and come back to life. They're also this was the movie that kind of popularized fast zombies. It's not the first fast, like the Return of the Living Dead ones are pretty fast, and there's like a few other like cult movies that had the fast zombies, but this, like, I think being kind of the mainstream hit that it was
racking like my brain first trying to figure a Fast and Furious joke with zombies, but it's just not coming. There's something there though. It's too fast, too. I don't know.
Y'all have a preference? Do y'all have a flavor of zombie you prefer? Do you like do you like the fast boys or do you like the slow ones?
Slow.
I hate to bring disagreement into this podcast, but I'm a huge fan of this movie, and the fact that they are so fast, you can't be beat. So
look, you can be a fan of this movie and still like slow zombies because they're not zombies in this movie.
it'd be great to have a movie zombies fighting against the infected.
There you go.
My money's on the infected.
Whoever wins, we lose.
Like, when they bite each other, what happens? I guess that's what we need to try to figure out there.
I kind of feel like the zombies win that exchange. Because the infected are still living people.
Yeah. I guess before we get into the meat of this and we dive more into this topic that will surely consume the rest of the show. Again, Jason, you mentioned you're a big fan of this movie. You're also like a pretty big Danny Boyle fan, right? I know you're like a big Trainspotting guy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are the only ones I really like. Trainspotting 2. I thought that was a pretty good too. But 28 Days Later, I don't know, it's so suspenseful. And you know me and suspense movies. Like, I do enjoy a good suspense movie. And I remember
a good thriller.
I saw this, I think right around my senior year of college. And I remember whenever I'd fill up my gas tank at night, I always thought back to that scene whenever like the zombies, like they're in the cab, like changing the tire and trying to assume it fast as they can. I kept reenacting that scene. And so I remember just kind of like getting back into my car as quickly as possible. And I can't remember another movie that kind of changed my behavior like that. So I have to hand it to Danny Boyle.
This movie comes in like kind of an interesting spot in his career. He was a theater guy who kind of got into movies like a little bit later. He was like in his 30s when he made Shallow Grave, which was like the first he and Ewan McGregor kind of came up. It's his first movie, huge hit in England, and it's like he was trying to make cool British movies in the 90s. He was like frequently compared to like Tarantino
or Guy Ritchie.
Yeah, I think he predates him a bit, but like but similar kind of vein where it's not Howard's End.
not Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, or like, you know, the kind of after GoldenEye, Pierce Brosnan, Bond movies. Like, that's like the other like British cinema worldwide hits. He's trying to kind of inject kind of the cool like Oasis and Blur Brit pop kind of Brit art into British filmmaking. Doesn't want to do like the same thing over and over again. He has a huge breakout hit worldwide with Trainspotting. goes to Hollywood and then kind of makes two famous flops. He had a chance to make Alien 4. He did not think he would be able to do it and didn't want to like do a franchise movie like that early in his career. But he does A Life Less Ordinary and The Beach. I don't know if either of you have seen either of those movies, but
no. I'm aware of both of them. I have not seen either of them.
You know, Life Less Ordinary is like, it does have people that like it a lot. It's I know you have a problem with tone being off in movies a lot, and that's a really weird, like, romantic, supernatural, but also like horrible crimes committed by like the protagonist type movie. Yeah. And The Beach was an infamous flop because it was like the first thing Leonardo DiCaprio did post Titanic, when like
was that with
like, nothing. Yeah, like it's Tilda Swinton's in it, but it's like the young tourist goes to Thailand and finds like the commune on the island of kind of like people who are living off of the land and, you know, kind of doing some shady criminal stuff too. That was written by Alex Garland, who wrote this. And it's like that was a cult hit novel that he adapted before he ends up like doing his own thing. We'll maybe save conversation about Alex Garland for another day, because he also made some movies that we might cover on this show. Nice. But yeah, he also pitched, hey, while you're doing The Beach, like I have this idea for like a movie about the collapse of society. And Danny Boyle was interested, and after those movies flopped and he did like some TV movies, got like a funding to make this, and kind of start filmed it sequentially and got more money as he went along by showing people like what he'd already filmed. I'm curious what y'all think about the look of this movie.
it was a bit amateurish.
Yeah, I was going to bring this up as well. Not for the amateurish thing, but I can see that. Is my poor eyes are not used to standard def in this day and age.
And it's a really intentional thing. Like this was right around when like the first filmmakers who were experimenting like on a major scale with studios were doing digital instead of shooting on film. And like kind of the pitch that everybody else was going with, like your Spielbergs and your Lucases and stuff, were like, oh, look at the detail. Look at like how great you can make something look when you film in like this super high res, like these state of the art cameras. And Danny Boyle kind of goes the other way. He's just like, well, if I get like the shittiest camera possible, it's like small and I can work with a small crew and I can go anywhere. And like, yeah. I think it also like really roots this movie in the time. And it's like that post-millennial early internet videos kind of gives it like that weird like cinema verite feel to it. Like, I don't know, I love it, but it's like I also feel real dumb owning the Blu-ray of this movie.
Right. what is it enhancing?
Yeah. But the I think it really just kind of reverberates with that, like that time period and that feeling of like right up front. Let's get into how this movie starts with footage of, if you think this is a zombie movie, like the first thing you're gonna think when you see this footage is like, oh, this is the fall of society as like infected or zombies are attacking. And the camera zooms back, and no, it's just the news. It's just like,
yeah,
real world events mixed in with stage stuff that they did for this, that they're showing to a monkey, a strapped down monkey in a lab.
I was not expecting a Clockwork Orange monkey at the beginning, even though as I think I've said before, I have seen this movie before.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, one of the things that they wanted to address was like, you know, societal rage in general. That's like the premise of this whole thing. But with the starting point being these like outbreak monkeys who are so mad it's infectious.
They're infected with rage.
We have our Animal Liberation Front that's like breaking them out. And I feel like this is like a 90s, early 2000s thing where it's just like liberal filmmakers felt like they had to be like, yeah, but we're not leftists, though. Those guys are crazy. Animal rights people. Look at how awful they are. Y'all seeing a lot of like animal rights terrorism in the news these days?
Not in the news.
They're in this research facility. They're gonna free all these chimpanzees because it's, you know, it doesn't look great. What's going on with these chimps?
No, it's a bad look for sure.
Yeah, they were caught red-handed. But I couldn't figure out did the chimps have this disease or did they cause the disease?
Unclear.
By showing them all this rage stuff.
This is one of those things that it shares with zombie movies where you're not quite sure where it came from initially.
Because I would like to try to do this. I'm trying to figure out if I can cause chimps to get this.
I think you could. I believe in you.
They did say that they're like the diseases that were on their minds that were kind of in the news at the time, because this is a movie that's very much in conversation with current events, where Ebola, which has a similar like blood-based like primate pathogen transmission method, and that's kind of like what they modeled it off of. But there was also like mad cow disease in England at the time, which like I'm gonna eat this hamburger and go fucking crazy
in like 40 years. Yeah, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen instantly. I thought it was more like ephemeral than that. Like the idea was they were trying to figure out why people or why there was so much fighting and anger and violence, and could they track down the source for where that comes from and eliminate it biologically. I didn't think it was based off of like a specific set of diseases that they were looking at.
Well, like maybe much like the scientist in this movie, you know, could have done a better job explaining. What's going on?
The security on this lab is horrible. You can't convince me that those monkeys couldn't have broken out of those plexiglass cages they were in.
Yeah.
I love that they, like, you know, the scientist guy comes in, he gets like confronted by these terrorists, like pinned up against the wall. He is scared. But it's like, it's not like they're not letting him talk. They're giving him like a moment, and like what he comes up with is just like, they're so mad. You don't understand. It's real bad because they're mad.
He does say they're infectious.
Yeah, but like I think like maybe just taking that moment, like, oh, I see, we have like a who's on first situation. No, this is like an extinction event.
Yeah. No, it's real bad. I know you just had to like barely jimmy a lock to get in here, but we really should have locked this down better.
In hindsight,
maybe it's on us.
But they do free these primates, and we get like our first glimpse at like really kind of a cool technique in this, because the people who get infected aren't the only ones that move fast. The chimps are also filmed the same way. They do like the film them at a reduced frame rate and then speed it up to 24 frames per second. That's how like a lot of that movement like just feels so chaotic and frenetic.
They did the same thing in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Babe Ruth also, like, you know, famously moved
in slow motion.
I had to have that explained to me, like, you know, why old movies look like that. Like they shot fewer frames, so when you play them back, okay. No, the people in the 1910s didn't just like
jerky walk
move
all over
around
the place
like that.
But they did have cocaine and Coca-Cola back then, which could have been part of the reason.
Yeah, I was gonna say Babe Ruth is not a great example because he may have actually walked that way.
But this our introduction, we get like the jump from that, from somebody getting bit and like the whole, this whole group getting taken out, like as they get attacked by the chimps and each other, to this, our opening, which,
dong.
I think in a in a movie full of just striking visual imagery, like
dong.
Long?
Dong. D-O-N-G, dong.
Yeah, no, we do see that Killian Murphy dick. We do get a nice
front center. Yeah, it's the one hospital with no, like their robe budget is all gone.
Or blanket budget.
Yeah.
I do love, because there's like
or heating budget.
Like, there's evidence that they were thoughtful about how they left him when they abandoned him here, because he wakes up in the hospital, and like the door to the room. There's evidence that he was
being treated like the bride from Kill Bill.
Yeah, like the whoever did this was like, all right, buddy, like I'm gonna leave the key in here. I'm gonna shut the blinds so nobody sees you. I do need to see that dick though.
I'll just jimmy them pants off. Time to pay the piper.
Time to see what the scarecrow's working with. Like, this is kind of Killian Murphy's first like breakout thing. Like, y'all have like strong Killian Murphy opinions. That's
this is the first thing I can remember him being in. I think he's fine in everything I've seen him in.
He's got like a real like he's a beautiful man, but beautiful like an alien. I think he's like,
he's too beautiful. That's what you're saying.
And like in this movie, his character Jim is not like, he's a very sensitive soul. He's like he's not a typical action zombie movie lead, right? Like he wants to go see his parents. Like he's arguing for like the inherent goodness of people constantly.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. That's not super typical of zombie movie protagonists.
Yeah, he's not capable right away. He wakes up in this abandoned hospital. And it's a very conscious choice. They're like, people say like, oh, wouldn't there be like bodies and, you know, just infected everywhere? It's a major population center. But it's like, I don't know, the movie feels so real, but like this dream-like exploration of like a place that we know should be occupied, like,
right,
it exists in our mind as being one of the most populous cities on earth and major landmarks. He's walking from like Whitehall to Big Bend, you know, I don't know, Baby Spice's house, and there's nobody there.
This sort of stuff actually really works for me. I like the idea of a place that should have people that has no people. It's a It like borderline that creepypasta stuff that I kind of get into, like that just kind of not quite real reality.
Yeah, I do want to get into. I love the score of this movie so much. Yeah. Like if I didn't do Selling the Scream, there's a chance I'd be like doing Pawning the Post Rock with you, because I fucking love post rock so much. But this Godspeed You Black Emperor track that plays when he's like going from spot to spot, and it's like the just building crescendo of like this cello and these guitar sounds until it's like it's spinning out of control as he cannot figure out what the fuck's going on. He does very quickly discard some newspapers that might have like filled him in a bit better.
I feel like maybe he doesn't do everything he can to be as informed as he should be. But I'll give that up. A little bit of a pass, because he did just wake up from a coma caused by a massive head wound.
Yeah, no, I also just love the like the look that he's got, like the surgery scar, and like you can see where they've shaved his hair away to do it, and the stubble's grown back there. They filmed this movie mostly sequentially, and like the few insert shots they had to like go back and do. They had to like build him this weird wig. But like, yeah, it's what's insane is like this feels like such a response to like 9/11 and like just like the panic in the air and like a center, like terror in a like populated center, filmed the week before 9/11.
Yikes.
Like they probably couldn't have filmed it if it was like 10 days later. Because they kind of got away with a lot of this stuff with like kind of handshake deals. They didn't really get permits. They would just like go there real early in the morning, see if they could talk somebody into holding traffic for like 5 minutes and like get what they could get.
So are you suggesting that we like give props to the airplanes? I don't know. I don't know how to take this.
No, I'm just saying that
without
it's like,
we wouldn't have this movie.
But like for a movie that's so evocative of that feeling in that time, to know that like this centerpiece portion, which feels like so much of like an upended world, was done like before that. Like it feels like Night of the Living Dead kind of has a similar thing where it has like it feels like it was made in response to like the JFK and Bobby Kennedy assassinations, and it's like it was filmed before it. It's kind of a weird time. I'm curious, like, if there's stuff here that like works for you as it's building to this crescendo, and he's like going from place to place and finding abandoned piles of money.
And he picks it up.
What were you saying, Jason?
I was just saying, like, yeah, he stops to pick up money, not realizing at the time how useless it is.
It wasn't useless before his head wound.
I do want to just interrupt here, and I've been trying to like work in some of our, you know, potential sponsors that we might have in the for the podcast, and just hey, buy some gold. Gold surely won't lose value. Everybody needs it all the time. No, buy gold.
I think it's an appropriate spot to put it here.
Stay tuned later for a commercial about reverse mortgages.
Well, this is like I kind of talked about like it being in conversation with like actual news. Like this was something that happened in Cambodia. Like there was like there's photographs of like when Pol Pot's driven out of Cambodia, like the currency immediately devalued and people like went into panic. And I think so much of this movie feels like a reckoning with kind of the idea of like the end of history and the kind of that idea of the late 90s, early 2000s that like still kind of persists a little bit today, that like nothing can fundamentally change, that like stability at all costs and like not to pay attention to like turmoil across the world. And, you know, a lot of which, you know, Western countries might be culpable in carrying out.
You don't say.
No, I just did.
No.
Right. Well, Jay, can you edit that out of the podcast? That made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, no problem, Jason. Here for you.
But he's not alone forever. He's not wandering Day of Triffid, the Triffid style, around an empty street. He does dip into a church. He seeks some salvation. And finds out the end is fucking nigh.
And my favorite part about that line right there is the work it would take to write that on the wall, because it was like up the stairs. And so you would need to get a ladder to write all that. And so like all this is going on and someone decides to spend the time to violate several OSHA regulations to write that on an interior wall, not even an exterior wall. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, I mean, you know. Banksy's gonna do what Banksy's gonna do, man. Like, can't stop him. This is like another real world thing where, like, in Rwanda and Sierra Leone, they would like when there were massacres, they would pile bodies in the churches. So he goes into the church. Like, there's some indication that he might be a nice Catholic boy. goes into the church and there's just bodies everywhere. And when he says hello, several heads pop up, and then he gets attacked by a priest.
Yeah, this is your not our first exposure to the infected, because we do see the very opening scene, but this is his first exposure to them. as much as I like the empty street stuff, it is weird that in a major population center like this, there are so few of the infected.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think they kind of try to make that up a little bit. They make when you see them count, but there's some indication that maybe people were fleeing these centers or whatever. But
yeah,
those aren't the questions I think this movie's really like.
Sure.
Super interested in exploring. No,
I don't need to go deep on it. I'm just it's something that I noticed when I watched it.
Yeah, yeah. But the priest who comes at him, that's actually the guy who trained all the zombies. We got another zombie choreographer like we did in Train to Busan.
That is a very niche profession.
I bet he was about to change jobs and give up on his dream, and then he got the call from Danny Boyle.
I mean, it feels like it had to be the story, right?
Yeah.
He's got a wife at home going, "You're going to make it, honey. You can't give up on your dreams." This damn zombie choreography is just going nowhere.
But he flees the church. He's being chased by a mob. And he gets help from some folks in like body armor and gas masks, throwing Molotov cocktails.
When you thought
of like stopping at the gas station, I thought this was where you were going. Is this gas station explosion where they?
Where my mind went first too.
this is like I think the most expensive shot in the movie because they blew up a gas station. So had the police called on them because, you know, they I guess they communicated with a lot of folks but not the authorities.
I thought this is part of their guerrilla filmmaking. They didn't tell anyone they're going to blow up this gas station. They just did it.
Including the family that owned the gas station.
Better ask forgiveness than permission.
But we find out that it's been 28 days later, of course, like the title of our movie, and he's rescued by two people who've been surviving, and they've been holing up like in a little shop in like the subway, behind a barricade, living off junk food. I'm a huge pessimist, but there is a part of me that every time I watch this movie, I'm just like, 4 weeks, huh?
I gotta wonder, like, is 28 days significant in some way? Like, could it have been any number? It just happened to be this number.
Yeah, I think it's just they wanted to communicate that again as two pessimists, the writer and our director here, that this is like
not
how tenuous how tenuous they saw. And like, you know, I think based on our real world pandemic experience now, they really skipped over that whole like people murdering each other for toilet paper at Costco phase of the pandemic.
Well, I mean, even prophets can't see everything.
But our two other survivors who have rescued Jim are Naomi Harris playing Selena, who is a more hardened of the two, and Mark, who tries to tell a lame dad joke while still wearing his terrifying gas mask and to ease Jim's mind.
I think Selena was well on her way to being hardened in her inside before the pandemic, before the infection started. I don't think she'd get there in 4 weeks.
I don't know. Those 28 days, I think you would.
it's a big time jump. It's a big a lot of dot 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 after that dot dot dot.
The yada yada yada, the zombie apocalypse.
It's kind of an interesting like subversion. I don't know. Like some of the Romero movies like start like Day of the Dead kind of starts at this point, but it's supposed to be like several years after. It's supposed to be like a bit more of a prolonged thing.
I think that's a point in this movie's favor because it, like I said, not a zombie movie, even though it shares a lot of DNA. It's not a movie about the monsters ripping people apart. I mean, I guess you could say that about most zombie movies, that's not really what the movie's about. But they're not interested in that. They're telling the story of the people who are caught in this and like the larger picture of how does, you know, your government or your country or the other countries in the world react to something like this happening.
Yeah, no, it's we get a lot of like that backstory is kind of just taken care of like in this scene, and then like in the a scene that's coming up real soon where the first thing that Jim wants to do, and you know, I guess his new friends are down for this because what else do they have going on?
They're not in a great spot.
They're going to go check and see his like family home and see if his parents are okay. Which they kind of make it there like without incidents. I think it's like kind of just like a crazy escalation in this movie that's like Jim goes home and finds his parents like in this heartbreaking scene. They've committed suicide. They're holding a picture of him and basically just saying like, please don't wake up. Like yeah, the world,
the note on the back is rough.
Yeah,
it said we left you sleeping. Now we're coming to join you. Don't wake up.
Yeah, and like imagine that, and then the people you're traveling with like come in and they're just like, oh, best case scenario.
Yeah, they die. They died peacefully. You should be grateful. Fuck you. Can you give me like an hour?
Guess we don't all get a storybook ending like some people.
Right. Stop telling me how great it is that my parents are dead and they didn't get eaten or torn apart.
Yeah, and it, like he's, I think, really a lot of his work here. Like I like Cillian Murphy a lot in this movie because I think it's like it's kind of on him to be the audience surrogate and just sell the horror of it because everybody else is like. Hardened yeah. in some way. I mean, after these 4 weeks,
he didn't see what happened. So we're coming in yeah. as same as him. We don't know what's going on. He's finding it out as we're finding it out.
Yeah. Before he, you know, goes downstairs and in the middle of the night and lights a candle and is like taking it all in and, you know, not a great idea, not a great move to, because they've already told him like, no, we all sleep together. Like we're
don't want to draw attention to ourselves. Low profile is the way to go.
I like that there's a lot of rules, and then like most of those rules don't look addressed. Again, we only move during the day. We do this, we do that.
Oh, now come on. There's a caveat to that rule, which is unless you have to.
this whole movie's have tos. I think a real interesting artistic choice here, where like I think for the first time or two I saw this movie, I thought he was watching home movies, but they film his flashback in 35 millimeter as he's like remembering the good times with his parents before he gets, you know, an infected couple charging through the window who attack him. I think they're pretty effective jump scares in this.
We think they're infected. They also just could have been real asshole neighbors.
Or just really, really protective.
Yeah.
Not in my neighborhood.
Caitlin's gonna set off the smoke detector. he gets jumped, and Mark and Selena come in from the other room, and he only survives because of them. He's fine. He doesn't get blood in his mouth. They're very concerned about that, but Mark gets a cut in his arm. And with zero hesitation, Selena just machetes the shit out of him. Which,
it's the smart play, but yeah, it's a little cold.
But like it also that's like Selena's character arc in this movie is that, yes. You know, that she's basically communicating with Jim, like, no, if I'm sticking together with people because that's the best way to survive. So I can like get sleep or have another set of eyes watching out for me. But like anything goes wrong, like I am looking out for me. And this is not like, another difference between like a zombie movie is in a zombie movie, you always have the guy that gets like bit and he's like hiding it, or it's real tragic as he's starting to slowly turn and you as the audience know what's going on. But this shit's like instant. This shit's like,
yeah. What did she say? You have 11 seconds. from the time they're exposed to they're tearing your face off.
Yeah. No, it's it not just fast zombies, fast infection. Yeah, they book out of there. They're kind of figuring out where they want to go. When we get kind of like, we kind of think Mark's going to be one of our main characters, so RIP Mark. But we're introduced to a new set of characters that join our band. We have, they spot Christmas lights up on, I think it's Belfrin Tower, kind of a famous building that got converted into luxury flats recently. Is that the British? You had family that lived in England for a while, Jason, right? Am I is that correct? Is that,
yeah, I'm going to have to phone a friend.
Flat's the correct terminology.
That is true.
All right. We don't want to put it in the anyone. Boot.
Yeah, they're lorries. Fanny means something different, right? That's the
sure does. Can we talk about cigarettes?
Maybe not that one. All right. But they see that's like a sign of people there, that there's these lights on. And when they get to the tower, they see that somebody is like piled up shopping carts down below. So there's, you know, evidence that somebody is like taking some precaution to barricade.
By the way, don't you hate it when people don't return their shopping carts?
Yeah.
Just put those things anywhere.
Yeah, I don't care if like the apocalypse is happening. Like, be courteous.
You know, that makes me mad, but what makes me really mad is when they almost put it away. When it's like barely touching the thing. It's like, oh, come on.
I think the worst is like when they put them up like just on the concrete above like where the parking spot is, like just jammed in. That's so
yeah, we're old.
The concerns of cool people. But they this is not quite as secure of a location as they think it is. They get chased upstairs. They meet another imposing figure in body armor who waves them through and lets them into a flat, tells them where they need to go, and fights off infected and was able to get back inside. And we're introduced to a cab driver named Frank and his daughter Hannah. I think like a big difference, you know, 20 plus years later seeing this movie versus when I saw it, is I used to think of this guy as like the old man and his daughter.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
It's me.
A spry young Brendan Gleeson. as Frank. And we're introduced to some other folks who are living, have managed to barricade themselves in, are very low on resources, but are taking people in to help out. And of course, like I think that there's like this conversation here that's kind of the philosophical crux of this movie in a lot of ways, between Jim and Selena, where they're kind of discussing like what they think of Frank and Hannah, who's his daughter is like, what, like 15 maybe. Yeah. That they spend a little bit of time with them and have a meal, and Jim is like, well, they're good people, like they took us in and they're warm and they're having conversations with us and they're, you know, they are decent folk. And Selena's like, well, they need us more than we need them. They're going to be a burden on us. And that's kind of this crux in how they view the world, whether, you know, it's you survive with community or looking out for number one. Y'all have any strong opinions on Frank and Hannah, these scenes in the apartment as they're trying to collect rainwater? And
this is maybe a little bit of a twist on a typical zombie movie thing too, because normally if you run into someone outside of the main group this far into the movie, there's something sinister at play, and these people are basically just exactly what they seem to be on the surface. They're kind, caring people who just want to not be alone or to try to get out of their situation. They're not going to try to eat people, or, you know, they don't have like a a cult of the infected or anything like that going on.
They could just as easily be the main characters of the movie.
For sure.
Yeah. And like we see a lot of their relationship where, you know, that Hannah appears like maybe just a little more like shy, you know, kind of a little bit more guarded than her like amiable cab driver father, you know, who's trying to salvage water off the roof and getting pissed off that it stopped raining in England.
Yeah.
Like, also like screwed up their filming of this movie because they kept trying to film scenes and it would be like pouring down rain. It's like, well, I guess we can't use this.
I was saying, like, the whole end of the movie is pouring down rain. Was that a choice?
Oh yeah, no, I think that's a reckoning. That's very intentional that there's no rain, and then at the end it's like just piss in buckets. Yeah, but like I love the like little touch that Frank is trying to like collect dew with plastic, because that's like some shit like I would have seen like on a video once, right? And like knew you could do, but had like no clue. Actually do it.
Yeah. Right.
Make it work.
I know this happens. People do it.
But they decide that they're gonna leave because they intercept a radio broadcast. Like, they're not able to pick up anything pointing the radio in most directions, but they're able to pinpoint on a signal that's promising salvation and seems to be actively broadcasting. And they decide that it's, with their limited resources and the position that they're in, that it is worth the risk to try to make this journey.
Well, I mean, it's sure death if they stay. They don't have enough supplies. They've got to do something.
Yeah. Yeah. So they head out. They use Frank's cab. Are you aware of this, like, British like cab, the London cab driver thing, the knowledge?
I mean, if you ask me specifics about it, I couldn't tell you the specifics, but I understand it's a very intensive process to become a cab driver.
It takes like 2 years of study because none of London's roads make any sense.
Yeah, they've got to know like everything.
it's like it's kind of a legitimately like impressive, crazy thing. I know there's like, you know, London's a city that's, you know, over what, 1500 years old at this point, yeah, and like, yeah, yeah, has been built out from then and has like multiple streets with the same names and like, right, nothing's just on a grid.
It's such an unassuming job to have such a high bar to enter for.
Which like makes it all the more impressive that Beauregard from Great Muppet Caper was able to do it, right? Like, that's
you stole the words from my mouth.
It only take you as far as the lobby.
Great movie. That might be my recommendation. Go watch Great Muppet Caper again.
If you haven't seen any of those Muppet movies, check them out. Yeah. They're pretty good.
But it's some. We have a lot of, on this journey, it's like, it's kind of like building this to be our main group and like a lot of investment in these characters.
Yeah.
They have their tense moment we already alluded to in the through the tunnel. I love that, like, this is a really fucking bad idea. Do you know how I know it's a bad idea? Because it's a really fucking bad idea.
It's fucking obvious that it's a bad idea. I agree. This is a bad idea. This is not the choice I would make.
Some real like burnout Grand Theft Auto shit they pull here, where like there's just a demons style available ramp in this tunnel to drive on top of cars with.
No, you don't understand. That's part of the training to be a cab driver.
Yeah, part of the knowledge.
Yeah.
We leave out a 2x4 here, we lay it down.
Right.
They can just, they razzle, have like dazzle. They have like cab driver vision. They can just, they see things different.
But we're like, we have this really tense scene. It's funny, I watched this with the commentary and like with Alex Garland and Danny Boyle, and they're both like, oh, this scene's so cliche, they have to change a tire, and then they kind of let it play out for a little bit, and they're like, sometimes cliches just work though, right? Like,
no, I agree with both of those stances. This is another one of those times where like nitpicky me comes in and I say, there's like six zombies infected. Sorry, my bad. There's like six.
Oh, of them. Yeah. But there's also rats. There's that rat scare where like that's the first thing that comes charging down.
Yeah.
So they're listening for as they have to change the tire, and then they get like charged by the infected, and we. So the rest of this score that's like very similar to that Godspeed You Black Emperor stuff at the beginning, this is the film's composer, John Murphy, kind of trying to recreate that sound, because Godspeed You Black Emperor was going to do more for this movie. They pulled out because, well, speaking again of leftist anarchist political dissent, this movie got more of a budget and they got angry about that. That there was going to be like fucking Pepsi in it and shit.
they don't want to be paid.
It is unconfirmed, but it is like the only reason that makes sense why this movie is unavailable for renting or streaming or buying anywhere. that these all these years later, they've just like these guys who are still around, still put out great music. Luciferian Towers, killer album from like 6 years ago. But yeah, they're the guys who win like Canadian Music Awards and then get like pissed off about like nice corporate sponsors for this event.
You know who wouldn't pull this bullshit? Goblin. Can you imagine this movie scored by Goblin?
Yeah, different vibe. I don't like, instead of slowly building tension, how about just like we just go batshit the whole time?
We never stop.
Another like use of music, I think Danny Boyle's great with picking out like jukebox style music to use and stuff like this, is the granddaddy song that plays when they go on their shopping spree, that they and it's a grand, I mean, I know it's not a zombie movie, it's an infected movie, but a grand Dawn of the Dead tradition of like society has collapsed, let's experience the joys of capitalism. So take all of the things.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's tons of crossover DNA here, but not a zombie movie. Yeah,
and this I this scene is just does so much work to really like get your buy-in that that they're all bonding, and especially I think Jim is like starting to feel paternal feelings towards Frank. Like later on, he literally calls him dad when he's like high and asleep. But they're like, I love the bit when Frank's looking at all the produce and there's only the Granny Smith apples that are perfectly fine and everything else is like rotted and he's just like irradiated. And like, you know, looking at fine whiskeys and telling Jim about them, and Jim's wandered off and then just filling his arms with them.
Yeah, no, I think I mean, you're onto something about the feeling, the paternal feelings, but I think it goes both ways, because he's definitely doing dad stuff trying to teach Jim about good alcohol.
But this granddaddy song that plays here is really, really great too. I think just kind of fits that like buzzed out version of like a happy shopping spree song in this movie, because there's really like, other than that subway attack, there's way more like calmness in this part. It's kind of showing the,
I had forgotten how much of a road trip movie this is.
Yeah, and they like, when they get out into the country, there's really like very few encounters that they have with infected. There's the one that Jim finally has to kill somebody. And again, like, because it's Jim and he's a sensitive soul and like everything around him has to be a fucking heartbreak, because that's just the face that Cillian Murphy has. Yeah. He has to kill a kid. And we learn that the infected can verbalize.
Yeah, that's freaky.
At least that he's he could say "I hate you," and gets, and before he gets brained, and like Jim can't even tell the rest of the folks he's with that he's you know, he's also finally had to cross that line too. But like most of the rest of this is like their shopping spree or them like kind of like in camping in the ruins of a prior civilization, seeing nature return, having like Ryan Eno play as they're watching wild horses. I guess this where they talk talk Frank into letting Hannah have some Valium so she can sleep because they figure out that's Selena's secret. It comes out that she used to be a chemist, so she's traveling around with a bunch of chemicals. She already like cured Jim's headache earlier by like recognizing he was sugar crashing. She gives them Valiums and Frank decides not to have one, but they're able to get to sleep, and his daughter has a, you know, half Valium for the first time. Originally that was going to be like harder drugs, and they said like it all of a sudden turned into a different movie and they needed to refill it immediately.
Turned into Trainspotting.
All of a sudden Begbie shows up and
somebody just had heroin.
But I think there's a lot of work that's done like here in this scene too, where not only is there like Jim calling Frank dad as he's like passing out from the Valium, there's also another conversation that I think between Jim and Selena where they're starting to like fall for each other, and again they're like talking about their worldviews and kind of like their inherent pessimism and optimism of the situation that they're in. Selena's immediately going to, and it's, I love that they're like projecting this. Like, what am I thinking right now? Well, you're thinking that you'll never read a book that hasn't already been written. You'll never hear a song that hasn't already been recorded. That, you know, basically like everything you love in this world is gone and destroyed, and nothing new will ever exist. And like, he's just sort of like, no, I'm kind of glad at the company I keep and the peace that's afforded. Like, there's something. There's the upside to the apocalypse that Jim sees.
As a, I mean, you got to do some gymnastics to come up with that silver lining, I think.
I mean, I don't think he's like super glad, but I think he's also like, we have found each other, and we have like survived because of trust and community and good faith. I think that's kind of like a recurring thing.
Right. He's not willing to just give up on everything because something terrible happened.
Yeah. Eventually they do reach Manchester, which is where these messages are being broadcast from. I love some of these like road trip shots. First of all, like the low res overgrown flowers that look like an abstract painting, like,
wow. was that not a painting? I could have sworn that was a painting, like done for effect.
I mean, I think they really dropped the res on it. It did not sound like they dropped it in as like an altered image, but it really looks like one. So I'm kind of curious if they're just sort of.
The reason I say that is it's not the first time that I saw that I've seen them do like play with a weird camera shot. There's a part earlier. When they're at Jim's parents' house and they're watching sunset or sunrise, I can't tell, but there's like a partition across the top of the screen where you can see part of Mark's mouth, and then it kind of pans down so the sunset goes away and this scene fades into, or just like slides down into them sitting inside. So it
Boyle's real showy, so it wouldn't surprise me if that was like an actual image. I know the one that they said people think is altered but isn't is the shot with the fans in the background, because it just looks so surreal, like the way the hill comes up over the ridge and with like the low res, the windmills. But that's like a real shot, and it, like the next shot actually has the computer stuff in it where you're just seeing it from behind. But the choice that they make as they're driving into Manchester to just have that, they're driving up the M1, which is like one of the busiest roads in England that they like partially shut down. And it's just that really slow, like tilt up because the city of Manchester has burned down and there was nobody to put it out. like, I think just a really effective reveal of just like, you know what's coming. Like, they're just making you like wait for to see it yourself.
Yeah.
Before they reach the checkpoint, there's nobody there. There's dead bodies and
not a lot though.
But the what's that?
Not a lot of dead bodies.
Yeah, yeah. It looks like their journey has been for nothing, and Frank gets very understandably upset, loses his temper, sees a crow feasting on like a up on a barricade, a dead person, and goes to, you know, kick the crow away, and one drop of blood falls directly into his eye. Another like really striking shot in this movie, because you get the like the blood drop cam drop down and hit him. Does this this effect work for you? I find this part like heartbreaking. It is an effective scene.
It's so well done. I mean, it definitely tugs on a lot of heartstrings as, you know, dad of a daughter, and like, you know, even just his, you know, he knows what's happening. He knows he has just a few seconds to go. Oh, so good. And like the blood reminds me of, remember that masterpiece we made, Josh, iZombie, where we had the from the urine shot? It was very, very similar.
Yeah, I mean, we are kind of the Danny Boyles of Loveland, right. Ohio, right?
And we made that before this one, let the record reflect.
I smell lawsuit.
You mentioned that, like, he processes all that in that like 15 seconds, however long it is that he has. Like, he goes from like, oh no, I'm fine, to like realizing like, oh no, I actually need to like communicate very quickly that they need to get the fuck away from me.
Yeah.
And like, is like pushing his daughter back, like, no, stay away. You can see him even start to like get captured by the rage, before the military shows up and guns him down.
I mean, there's a moment there where you think Jim's going to have to do it.
No. And he's like, you know, it's unclear whether he would have been able to or not.
That is definitely crossover from a zombie film.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we kind of get into the sort of contentious back third of this movie. I feel like when it came out, there were a lot of people I talked to, or like people I'd recommend this movie to during Blockbuster days, who would be like on board for everything in this movie, and except for the last third. I think the last third is like the hardest thing to kind of wrap your brain around. It's maybe the most nihilistic bit of the movie about human nature.
It's a big swing. And this also kind of ties into what I was saying before about how, you know, we meet Frank and Hannah, and if it's a zombie movie, you would think something sinister is going on here. This is where that comes in. Everything seems fine on the surface, but just under the surface, things aren't quite so okay.
Yeah, it's a military outpost. It's probably like, what, like maybe like
6-7 guys?
I think it's more than that, but not by much. It's like, it's maybe like a dozen or so soldiers manning this, like an English manor house. They're like all up in Brideshead Revisited. Up in here, kind of maintaining polite British society and keeping the monsters at bay, or so we are led to believe. The leader of this group is I kind of mentioned like this movie not having like introducing a lot of people. Brendan Gleeson was like in a bunch of stuff before he was in this movie, and Christopher Eccleston would be the other person who was like in stuff before this, who's got, you know, if anybody knows Christopher Eccleston, it's got, even though he was a Doctor Who, resting villain face.
Yes.
he's Major West. They've got this point on lockdown, and we're kind of started by giving, he gives Jim this tour, and they kind of mention the commentary, they talk about like the kind of father figure stuff too, like that he also is like a potential substitute father figure of like this guy who's got everything in order and is strict and operates by the book as British military efficiency. But curious, like, what y'all thought of, like, the setup before we get the twist of what they're actually up to, like, how we start to see that things might be rotten here.
You know, the first thing that I thought was kind of funny about the major is just how, you know, he talked about how there was violence before and rage before, which was true. And I think Danny Boyle did a great job at the beginning showing all those images of all the violence, but it was ratcheted up several, you know, degrees with this rage virus. But like, he was just like not seeing the distinction. And it reminded me of kind of like an, you know, 2020, when people were like, there's no difference between Biden and Trump. I'm just going to vote third party. They're all exactly the same. It's like, there could be some more commonalities than there really should be, but there are some pretty big differences. And so like his point of view there is like, okay, there's something off here.
Yeah. That was the conversation with one of the other soldiers under his command, who basically said, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, Earth's been around for a long time. Humanity's only been here for basically a couple of eye blinks. If we go away, that's just things returning to normal. And then on the flip side, you had the major say, well, I mean, as long as I've been around, people have been violent shitheads, and they're still violent shitheads, so nothing has changed.
I don't see a difference. And I think that's also like something to kind of do with that, like, that end of history idea that I feel like is just like still causing so much damage, where people just kind of like refuse to believe like an alternative, and things just have to keep maintaining order in the same way that they did before, even when it doesn't make sense anymore. I think that's a lot of what this movie grapples with, especially like the Jesus Christ, the British military.
You know, I guess there's some history there. We got time.
But there's things that they start to see, like Jim sees out the window some soldiers picking on one of their own soldiers. It's the Jones, who's like no chinned runt of the litter of this group of guys, who's their like cook, who's been like forced into this like feminine role in a house of toxic masculinity, like wearing a pink apron and gathering up supplies and being harassed constantly. Sure. By everyone else in the command. And then the last thing that West shows him on his tour is that one of the soldiers there has turned, and they're keeping him chained up. He says he's teaching me things. I thought he could teach me more, but what he's teaching me now is how long it takes to starve to death.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't necessarily think they're, I think that's the thing that's like always terrifying about like infected and zombies too, is like, you can't, it's easy to make the separation in your head that they're no longer people, but they're people. And like, you have this guy who's like chained up, and you have the guy who's like willing to do this. The guy who's like willing to just watch this go down. And maybe that's a necessity in this situation for this information, but like, it tells you about who's doing it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They have their dinner, which we already kind of alluded to, where we see that there's a little bit of dissension in the ranks. There's one sergeant who's kind of not quite on board and has a theory, which turns out to fucking bear out, that that the world has not been destroyed, that England has been quarantined, that it never got out, and that everyone else in the world is just watching the fucking Simpsons. Which, you know, I mean, if you're going to watch something, the world burns right now. I may or may not have like started a Simpsons rewatch during the height of the pandemic here.
I no better time.
But we're eventually given into there's an attack. They all spring to Jones, the one who's like coded as being the feminine, who fucks up dinner, gets his first kill. So he's like, his whole demeanor kind of changes. He's one of the boys now. And then there's women there, and we learn that their goal and putting out the message was to get women there because they think they're going to have to repopulate the earth again.
Yeah, you got to rebuild. You got to rebuild. You got to rebuild.
Yeah. But you know, if that was really the goal of their message, the message should have said that they had like Taylor Swift tickets. I think that would have been more effective.
Boo. That's not the type of show this is.
We have shirtless pictures of hunks.
Brand new appliances.
West also like invites Jim in, is just like, hey, here's the plan. We're gonna like keep these women as sexual slaves. You want in?
You could be a part of this on the ground floor. It's an exciting opportunity.
So like, you know, Jim runs and tries to tell them they need to go. He gets, you know, they get caught before they leave. He gets captured. The sergeant, Fuller, who was the one who was like disagreeing before, also tries to like stand up and fight back.
Yes, he was helping them escape. He was not going to let he was going to let them leave if they wanted to leave. He was not going to force them to stay.
Yeah. Before they get captured, and as the women are gotten ready to meet with their soldiers, Jim and Fuller are marched out into the field. We get another one of our soldiers that we probably need to talk about a little bit, Mitchell. You know, great guy, great the most upstanding member of this unit, who tells Jim that he's gonna make Selena squeal. Yeah, cool dude. Yeah, great times.
My idol.
And like such a fucking scumbag that he's not even gonna waste a bullet on his like his sergeant. He's gonna stab him with a bayonet. Ugh, what a piece of shit.
Yeah. He sucks.
But we have this like this chaotic scene where like they part of the fun of this is like they were trying to like write themselves into a corner a little bit. They have a disagreement as Jones and Mitchell, and Jones doesn't want him to just stab him with a bayonet to death, so he shoots Fuller, and in like the confusion and the anger, they turn back and Jim's gone, and he is able to escape the compound, and they just, you know, in grand military fashion, well, he's not here anymore.
I mean, what's the worst? To be fair, he doesn't have a weapon, his hands are tied. He's out in the middle of nowhere, and all the infected from Manchester are allegedly in the area. So,
yeah.
So it sounds like Jed's no different than Mitchell in terms of.
Listen, I've been telling you that this whole show.
I do like, as difficult as it always is to like talk about like scenes that involve either real or implied sexual assault, especially like in this case involving a child, there is like a kind of a great character moment for Selena later on where she's like, look, I'm gonna get Hannah ready for y'all, but y'all need to leave the room, and then starts feeding Hannah drugs, and Hannah's like, are you trying to kill me? She's like, no, I'm trying to make it so you don't care. I'm trying to get you very high right now.
Yeah, she's already had several moments where she's expressed how much she thinks, how much she's trying to shield Hannah from what's going on.
Yeah, and this, they've kind of at this point, like especially after like the death of Frank, like have gelled into a family unit, them against, you know, these soldiers, and kind of at the end of the movie, you know, explicitly living together kind of as a you know, traditional family. But this is where Jim escapes, and not only does he escape, he looks up and sees that there's a plane flying in the sky. So Farrell was right. There are people still in the world. There are like militaries and governments still operating, because there's a jet in the sky. And that gives him license to go rage crazy.
That unlocked his inner Rambo, I guess.
So I think a lot of the John Murphy score in this part that's kind of aping Godspeed You Black Emperor is like, you know, maybe slightly sub Godspeed You Black Emperor. I like it fine enough. This music that plays at the end of this movie, this whole like Jim going from inside to outside, this in a house in a heartbeat, eats fucking Godspeed You Black Emperor's lunch. It is such a crazy amazing. I know you don't notice like score stuff a lot, Jed. I don't know, Jason, yeah. If you like.
Oh, I definitely notice definitely a lot more than Jed too.
I'm not arguing that at that point. That's fine. I take in the whole. I don't break it down into pieces.
All right, Mitchell.
my Mitchell. This bit is so good, and like the same composer does Sunshine with them later too. That both those movies have scores where like other movies just like straight up steal that piece because they're like, well, we want this, and instead of writing something that sounds the same, this song actually rules. We're just gonna pay for this song. So like, I think Big Daddy and Kick-Ass, this is like his theme too.
All right, yeah. I mean, if it ain't broke.
Curious what y'all think of this, like, of Jim, our sensitive boy. He starts to get filmed like he's infected. He starts getting that same frame rate filming, and he hatches the plan to basically get back into the house and save them, and goes on a murder spree. How does this work for y'all?
I think I understand what they're going for. I'm not sure I buy it completely.
Okay. He's infected with the rage too.
I mean, he's pretty good at like tactical, you know, things compared to like the British military. So he was like a bicycle messenger, and he took a lot of them out.
I mean, we talked about what kind of training cabbies had to go through before, but we didn't talk about bicycle messengers. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You have to like it's kind of John Wick style training. You have to be able to like, you know, do equilibrium style moves.
I think this part would have, and to be clear, it's not that I didn't enjoy this. I think it would have made more sense if it seemed more sloppy and less tactical.
I mean, he does enlist the infected. He does like, you say tactical. I think he's just sort of like unleashing chaos and hoping that that works, and it kind of does. But it's also it's kind of like the righteous fury of the situation. He starts signaling the alarm so that all the infected will come to the gates. So they need to like curb that real quick. So we've seen they're not like invulnerable in their position. It's just well defended, and they're able to like repel when attacks come. But they also don't need like an air siren's worth of infected coming descending on their position.
I think part of the reason that this I have a hard time getting into this as much as I want to is like, this is the perfect example of, oh, if I was in this situation, this is how I would handle it, which, you know, you have when you're watching these sort of kind of power fantasy things happen. But it's the idea of me being in this position and doing these sort of awesome things is constantly ruined by the reality of me being who I am.
Like climbing up the outside of a house, you're just like, oh, I'd be so out of breath.
It's like, no, I wouldn't be able to do it. I mean, I'd be out of breath
from steps.
Like... just on your back like a baby turtle.
Right.
Take me now, Jesus.
I had a good run. All right, so we're closing in on the end here. Let's push through. Get to the end.
Push through. Yeah, got it. He enlists the infected. He goes back. He frees Mailer. Mailer's attacking people. The people that are turning are attacking people, and he's kind of like dipping out like of windows and making his way slowly up back to the up top where Hannah's both high as hell and like telling all the soldiers that like everybody all the other soldiers are dead and you're gonna be dead next. He's able to finally get to Mitchell, who's the last one left with Selena and Hannah. And give him really the death that he deserves. That slow, prolonged pushing the thumbs into the eyes.
Yeah, this is a God of War cutscene or quick time event.
Before he goes to Selena, and Selena doesn't know what he's been filmed, like he has the rage virus this whole time. He hasn't said a thing to her. And boy, I don't want to say I never test if a partner loves me, but I might not do this.
I mean, especially when she has expressly stated on more than one occasion that she will not hesitate, bitch.
But she does. That's where we get our song title, in a house in a heartbeat, longer than a heartbeat. She stops. We get our reunion, our triumphant hero, and then hand smashes the bottle on his head. They flee. West gets another great death after he shoots Jim in the gut, and he's in the car with Hannah, and Hannah, who's been shown to be a crazy driver, because she doesn't know yet, drives back to the house and dumps him right at Mailer's feet. He pulls him back through the back window of the cab and tears him off back into the house. So ending of this movie, they drive, they hit the gate. We get a fade to black. We get the 28 days later. Original ending, Jim dies. They go to the hospital. They can't save him. They decided shit, we made our bleak movie too bleak. They go back, they refilm, they do it in film. So this is a big jump. This is where folks who have the Blu-ray, get a little treat, get a little that high res last 2 minutes of the movie. As you think maybe he's in hell because you see hell spelled out, but no, it's hello. They've seen the zombies are starving. They've seen a plane in the sky. And why wouldn't you trust the military at this point?
You I don't get though is why they spelled out hello versus help, because you saw her working so much on creating all that fabric for the letters, and they created a whole extra letter. They could have just wrote help.
Right, she would have been done.
They had to tear down the curtains, which he was upset about when he woke up. It was an extra letter, unneeded.
Thumbs down. Maybe they weren't thinking clearly.
Yeah,
they've been through a lot.
Which is why I cannot recommend this movie to anybody.
I mean, we're not there yet, but we'll take that into advisement when we get to the sales floor.
Well, I know we're at a little bit of a premium on time for this one, so let's just go ahead and pull up onto the sales floor. I can talk about End of History and post-rock bands for days, but
right.
I think this movie is absolutely phenomenal. It's probably it's certainly, I think, top three zombie / infected movie for me. I think that top is pretty crowded, but it's really, yeah, it recontextualizes a lot of stuff. I think it's brilliantly made. I think that we can talk a lot about just the showy stuff that Boyle does, but there's certainly ways he's filming through reflections, or as they're driving through the tunnel, filming from the inside of the cars that they're driving over. I think this thing is just top to bottom masterpiece. I think the people that don't like this last third, I don't get it, man. It's if you're playing within the Romero wheelhouse, that dude wasn't super fond of the military either.
It is textbook zombie movie stuff that happens here.
Yeah, no, it's all in conversation with that stuff. And I also agree that as much as I love a good bleak ending, I think it would have been too much in this movie. I think they made the right choice.
Yeah. I agree. Completely agree.
I agree with that as well. If Jim had died, that would have kind of undercut the entire. I don't know. Because if they were to show Selena and Hannah still kind of making a go of it on their own, that could prove that Jim's thought process was infectious, like the rage was.
Oh, okay. Hope is infectious. Okay. Yes.
I think that could have worked
out. So, did you just talk yourself back into buying this movie after that horrible help hello snafu?
No, listen, I was always there. I think that this is my favorite movie about the infected, or zombies, either one. I'm a big fan. I thought the last third of the movie was great because it gives you kind of like a full 360 view of kind of the terror that you would experience with something like this. You know, the first half, you know, the first two thirds, all about these infected. And then like the last third, like it reflects the fact that with a complete societal breakdown, which can happen, you know, sooner than 28 days, you also see the very worst of people, but also sometimes, you know, the very best too. So I thought it was great. It kind of took some of it out of like the supernatural type realm a bit to kind of get, you know, kind of multidimensional. I won't say horror because I don't like horror movies, but multidimensional suspense. And so I'm a big fan.
Okay. I like this movie too. I've seen it before. I liked it then. I liked it this time. It's not a zombie movie, but it's a pretty good zombie movie.
Yeah, no, it's in conversation, even if it's not a zombie movie. So yeah, I awesome. So I got this Crispin Glover Award for Acting Excellence to pass out here. And Jesus Christ, I mean, the dude was just nominated for an Oscar this year. I'm giving this thing to Brendan Gleeson. Like, Frank, Jesus, like, he does so much with so little here. And like, you know, I think I struggle to think of like a death in a horror movie that hits me as hard as his, because like he earns it.
his death here is what that type of death in zombie movies strives to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this it's heartbreaking. It's like you both feel for him, and you also like, it's like, wow, would I have like the wherewithal in that moment, like knowing like what was happening to take the steps that he took. And like, it's just so tragic too. So that it's like that moment of blind rage that like just absolutely does him in. Absolutely wonderful shit. So I've got a game here, and then I think we'll pull up into business stuff here to determine what movie we're going to do for next time. So this is like, you've been on six times. So Jason, I'm going to let you, I'm going to read a movie that's kind of associated with
movies.
I'm going to read a description of a movie that I would pair with each of the six movies that you've done. It's going to be not a great description of that movie. But these all have like something to do with all the films that we've covered with you before. So, and then I think what we're going to do is we're going to have Jed go ahead and veto three of them at the end, and then you'll get to pick from the remaining three. Do the rules of the game make sense to both of y'all?
Way too complicated, but I'm in.
Sorry, I love complicated.
Shut up,
games.
I'm in.
So you're going to give a description. I'm supposed to guess what movie you're talking about of the six that I considered in.
So here's the thing.
You don't have to guess which movie it is. You just have to pick which description sounds good to you after I tell you which three you can't pick.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so our movie to pair with 28 Days Later, my description is, a bunch of contrarian nerds try to unfix global warming. So you get the gist of the game that so far. Next movie we did, next one back, Perfect Blue. A mediocre musician becomes an even more mediocre detective after he meets a psychic. Nice. Night of the Hunter. Family pays the price when two grandpas get into antiquing. Psycho. An MCU favorite tries to find love in the big city, but his hobbies get a little out of hand. We did The Fly. The movie I pair with this one. A surprise Oscar nominee this year stars as a woman with a new lease on life thanks to her girl boss job. Blue Velvet. A prequel of sorts to Iron Man with an uplifting message about the power of love. So, Jed, why don't you go ahead and just eliminate three choices from there? Do you need repeats? Do you need?
I'm gonna eliminate Blue Velvet. I'm gonna eliminate Night of the Hunter. And what was the second description again?
A mediocre musician becomes an even more mediocre detective after he meets a psychic.
What was the third one?
Yeah. That was Kronos. Sorry, I'll spoil it because you've already eliminated it. Night of the Hunter. That was the family pays the price when two grandpas get into antiquing. So that one's already been eliminated. I'm bad at my own games.
Let's get rid of Perfect Blue as well.
So, Jason, that leaves you with 28 Days Later, Psycho, and The Fly as your movies. I can read those descriptions again.
I have to pick one?
Yes. So, 28 Days Later.
Was The Fly the one with the girl boss energy?
Yes.
Let's do that one.
Let's do that one. All right. Our surprise Oscar nominee is a favorite from a movie we've done before, Andrea Riseborough. She was nominated this year, but we're not doing the movie she was nominated for. We're doing Possessor, a movie by David Cronenberg's son, Brandon Cronenberg. Very similar wheelhouse. So let's thanks for helping us pick that one out, Jason.
Nice.
Yeah. My pleasure.
Available uncut version on Hulu for everyone right now, and that's a movie that, like, being on a Disney streaming service uncut is kind of wild. But yeah, is there anything y'all want to recommend to talk about before we get into business stuff?
I went to a place today for my kid's birthday called Arcade Legacy, which is a pretty rad little spot.
Oh, nice.
They have lots of local
Cincinnati hotspot.
Yeah, it's kind of like almost a GameStop on the front of it, where they do like trade-ins and stuff like that, but they have lots of games and movies and memorabilia and stuff like that. But then they also have a whole section of the building which is just arcade cabinets and pinball machines, and they have an area downstairs where they have a whole bunch of TVs and older TVs, like CRT stuff, so that you can hook up any console to it and play down there. They have space for like gatherings and things like that. It was really fun. They charge, you can either buy by the hour or spend $10 to spend as much time as you want, and everything's free.
Awesome. Sounds good. I'll shout out a video game real quick too, because I just got the Resident Evil 4 remake, and Resident Evil 4 is probably my favorite video game of all time, and it's good. It's real, real good. If you like Resident Evil 4, you'll love it. They change a lot of stuff, but I think it's a kind of a cool remix. And it,
I have heard all the remakes are great. I'm looking forward to getting some time with some of them at some point.
Well, I've gotten into a new podcast. It's called Selling the Scream. Amazing premise. There's this one guy who loves horror movies, but you also have on the other side, for the counterpoint, horror movie noob. So it's great. There are at least six really good episodes.
At least, yeah. I think most people would agree with that.
Yes. All right, so let's talk a little business. Please reach out to us on the Facebook group. We'll let you in there. If you'd like to inject some juice into the corpse of Twitter and see if it starts wiggling around, bite it, like, give it a chimpanzee bite, see how mad it gets. We are still on Twitter.
I don't think you want to test that, Josh. I believe that it can still get pretty mad.
Our email is sellingthescream@gmail.com. If you could leave us a review on the podcatcher of your choice, the iTunes and Spotify drive the most traffic. It does say here in this iOS group, Jason, have you heard this, that they keep changing what they want you to do with bad reviews? Have you heard this?
Yeah, go on.
Thanks for indulging.
Thanks for working with the bit. If you leave a bad review, they're just going to email you a picture of your father looking very disappointed. Who wants that?
That's the worst.
But yeah, until next time, join us for Possessor. And I want to thank again Jason Duff for taking the time to talk through this this baller flick with us.
Right. On this, his last episode, apparently.
But yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah. Awesome to have you on, as always.
It's a lot of fun.
All right. All right. Thanks so much. Join us next time for Possessor. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, thank you.